I want to paint a picture so that we can try and get in the head, as far as is possible for people that lived so long ago, of Christians that Paul was writing to. Who were the people he was writing to? How were they feeling when he was writing to them? So I just want to lay out a few thoughts. The first one is they were a tiny minority, even at the highest estimates of how many there were hardly any Christians in the world outside Israel. And they lived in little pocket-sized communities dotted around the major cities across the Roman world for the most part. So cities like Ephesus, and then you might know some of the other famous Bible cities like Galatia, Philippi, Colossae, Laodicea, and so on. And these are the places where you'd see a couple of hundred Christians maybe, all in small house churches. And the other thing to say is their lives did really stand out. We often talk about wanting to stand out as Christians, but we live in a world where, for the most part, it's been fairly Christianized. Whereas in the ancient world, a Christian was just a completely different kind of person to the people they lived with. They worshipped different gods, they behaved in a different way. Their core values were just a completely different way of looking at the world. And so there was no hiding the fact you were Christian. You felt very exposed and very obvious. The third thing I just want to point out here, they probably heard almost nothing from other people about what was going on in the wider Christian world outside the church that they were in. We obviously, you know, we don't have guest speakers that often, but we've got the internet, email, we're part of Pioneer, so, you know, some of you might get the email update every month or whatever it is. But it's all over the news, and generally we just see it everywhere. So we know all of what's going on. But they, followers of Jesus, basically their form of communication was they'd walk and they would see each other in person, and it might be a week or two between towns, and that was how messages were passed along. Paul's letters, you'll see, often say, I've entrusted this letter to Tychicus or to Timothy, and they would carry them by hand on a long old walk, and that was how messages went around. And they might have had, I'm guessing here, but like maybe 10 messages a year. They certainly weren't extending constant, because it's a huge job to have someone walk 2 weeks. I can't imagine people did it endlessly. And 10 on the one hand may sound a lot, mightn't it? But imagine if that was all the communication you basically ever had from the outside world. Thanks, Adam. Oh, he's even found where I was. Isn't that great? So, you know, no email. They weren't allowed to use the post system. That was for the empire only. No phone, all this kind of stuff. So they were completely cut off. And then one last thought is not to forget 30, 40 years, we said earlier. It's a really young movement. It's not established at this point. And you can imagine how vulnerable that must have made them feel. They don't know it's going to go on forever. They very much believe God that it will. But it's not proven to have lasted 1,000 years at this stage. And so I just want you to add all those different ideas together. And the people that Paul was writing to would have felt generally quite alone. They would have often felt quite isolated, like a tiny minority. They would have felt quite exposed because of how different they were. They would have felt quite vulnerable because of how young it was. And so you have all that, but then there was this one thing. Obviously, there's God. That's not the one thing I'm referring to. And this one thing was Paul. Paul was a man who was always on the move. He was, you know, scarred face, careworn, tired, probably exhausted. Imagine his joints were arthritic and all sorts because of the constant travel. But he was the one who led the churches like Ephesus that are outside of Israel. Probably about half the people in the world that were Christian at the time lived in and around Israel up to Antioch. And the rest of them were just dotted around these cities. And he was the one that led them. He was the glue that tied all of them together. And I expect a lot of times, like we see in books like Corinthians, his wise, calm voice is what kept them sane. So try and imagine, if you possibly can, that you are one of those people living in Ephesus. Try and imagine you feel vulnerable and alone, if you can. And just imagine how grateful you are for a man like Paul, that you can trust him, that you know he's always around, wise, sensible Paul. But then imagine you get news. Paul's back in jail. And this time it looks like he could be in jail for a very long time. And he was. So that's roughly the mindset you need to try and have when you come to the book of Ephesians to make sense of why Paul writes what he does. And of course, we call it the letter to the Ephesians, but Paul was actually writing a letter to a whole bunch of churches in what we call Turkey, because he wants to share a message. And that's because he's concerned about something. It's not that a crisis is underway. Sometimes he writes a letter to a specific church to deal with a particular problem that they've got. Instead, he wants to get out ahead of something, I think. I think he can imagine how they're feeling, like we can now. And he knows how fragmented and alone they feel. And he knows how much they need him. And he knows how terrifying it must be for them to hear that he's now in jail. And he knows this movement's still a baby. He knows that if the leader of a movement ends up in jail, it can kill it entirely. If they can't stay united and avoid infighting, it might implode. We see it all the time these days with like political parties and things. And so I think if you read the letter to the Ephesians with all that in mind, you can see that it shapes Paul's thinking in nearly every paragraph of the letter, what he's trying to do. So just for example, it starts like this. He says, "In all his wisdom and insight, God did what he had purposed, and he made known to us the secret plan he had already decided to complete by means of Christ. This plan, which God will complete when the time is right, is to bring all creation together, everything in heaven and on earth, with Christ as head." I'm just going to read that last bit again. "This plan, which God will complete when the time is right, is to bring all of creation together, everything in heaven and on earth, with Christ as head." So Paul started his letter by explaining that God has a plan. And that is in itself very reassuring for these people. He's saying, don't panic. God has a plan, and that through Jesus, at the right moment, God's going to bring everybody together, all the people in the world united. And when you think about it, ever since the fall, start of the Bible in Genesis, things start going wrong. Everything's breaking down. Relationships are splitting apart. Nations are fragmenting. People stop trusting each other. They become more divided. Instead, they should be united. And so on the cross, what Paul's saying, what took place, is that Jesus has started to set that in reverse. So rather than everything splitting and breaking and crumbling, things can start piecing back together again. And through the power of the Holy Spirit, we can overcome the kind of behaviors that in the past led to division. Through reconciliation, we're able to fix relationships that are broken, and we can start to undo some of the damage. And so Paul, I think he wants us to picture a world where one day, because of what Jesus did, everything and everyone is working together again, as it should be, as they should be. And I think that's important because the word unity, at least to me, has become like a little bit twee lately. I think it's a very corporate word nowadays. But in the way that Paul paints it, unity's everything. Unity is the whole story of the Bible. It's about reuniting us with God. It's about reuniting us with each other. You can't get a much bigger idea, a much more important idea than that. And he takes that idea and then he paints it across this whole letter that he writes to the people in Turkey. And there's no more division between Jews and Gentiles, he says. All dividing walls torn down. Everything's replaced. We've got one baptism, one communion. We are one body. There's all this sort of, there's like a drumbeat throughout the book of one this, one that, one, one, one. You'll notice it when you read it. He's always talking about how there's one church. And then halfway through the letter, as Adam took us last week, there's this word that stands out, which is therefore. And as Adam said, you've kind of got Paul laying out this big picture of unity. And then he says, therefore. So the question is, what does this mean for how we live today? What does all this big picture sweep of what God is doing mean for my life, your life, and the life of the people that Paul was writing to? So he pivots in his letter to explaining about that. He says, it means putting off our old ways of living, things like boasting and holding grudges and putting ourselves first the whole of the time. And these are the kinds of things, of course, that lead to division, that create division. And he then goes on to explain how we are to live out that vision of unity in our church, in our churches, and in our families. And so we'll be looking at families next week, but we're looking at unity in the church this week. And he uses the image of a body. And it's one we speak about a lot. Christ's the head, and you've got all these different pieces of the body, eyes, nose, ears, toes, gallbladders, etc. And they all work together in different ways, doing different things. But Paul understands that working together in that way is not easy, particularly when people are involved, because people are rarely easy. And so Paul begs them. He begs them like this. He says, lead a life worthy of your calling. You've been called by God. Always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other. Make allowance for each other's faults. That one struck me lately. Because of your love. Make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit. Bind yourselves together with peace. For there is one body, one Spirit, just as you have been called to one glorious hope for the future. So I just want to spell out what Paul says unity requires. The first thing is humility. So we've got to keep Christ and we've got to keep each other at the center, not ourselves. We've got to calm down our ego, you know, fewer ego clashes, and just make things generally less about us and focus on trying to make other people thrive. And then gentleness. When we are having to deal with hard relational things, do it gently. Soften hard truths. Do it with kindness, with love. And on the other hand, when you're receiving tough feedback sometimes, take it gently. Take it in the best possible spirit. It says patience. We need to allow time for each other to grow. Sometimes people join and it takes time for people to understand what being part of the community involves. Sometimes it takes a huge amount of time. I'm certainly not a finished product. We need to not jump to conclusions, not make snap judgments about people. All these kinds of things are part of patience, Paul's getting at. And then the one that I've been saying stuck with me is making allowance for each other's faults. Because Paul doesn't give us like an upper limit to how many faults people are allowed to have, which is disappointing. But basically, like, we've got to accept we're all human. We're all a bit broken. We're all being restored in Jesus, but we're not finished. And you imagine the level of closeness they lived in Ephesus. We don't quite have to put up with that. But when you live in close community with people, even, you know, the most perfect people can at times be hard to work with. You can't fix everyone. But I will caveat this. It doesn't mean that we are excused from continuing to work on our own faults. It just means that we should all extend grace to each other as we continue to grow in Jesus. And then finally, love. I mean, love's one of those broad topics, but I think the headline here is that only love, I think, is able to hold together a group of people as diverse as the church should be. And you can't do it without it. So to sum up, I think it's as simple as this. Always put everyone else first. So it's always put everyone else first is the summary of some of what Paul's saying there. And I think it's only when you begin to understand this that we're to live for other people and not just for ourselves, that I think you can then start to think about Paul's next idea in a way that's helpful rather than potentially ego-boosting and damaging. And that is that in the letter of Ephesus, Paul says we are each God's, the word in Greek is poema. So we're God's poema, which is where we get the word poem. And I find that a really, I like words. I like that as a way of thinking about it. But we're God's workmanship is how I think the more boring translations translate it. We're God's artwork. It's that kind of language that you are God's, you know, creative expression. And so your story, your background, your strengths, your weaknesses, the things you've struggled through are all part of that poem. I'm going to call it a poem from now on. And God has given you unique gifts, ministries, and wonderful things you can use to bless the church, to bless community, to bless your friends. And he's given you lots of good works that he's planned for you to do. Paul explains all of this in the letter, and we go into some of it in some detail in a previous series last year, specifically about gifts and ministries. So I'm not going to rehash all that now, because it's a series in its own right. So instead, I want to focus on this. You have gifts and ministries, take time to work them out, get good at them, that kind of thing. And the church relies on you playing your role. So your ministries aren't about you looking really impressive. Instead, they're about you serving others as best as you possibly can. Going back to the image that Paul gives us of a body, no part of the body is spare. No one in the church is an appendix or an adenoid. You might not all be the head. In fact, Christ is the head. But we're all needed to use our gifts and strengths for the good of the church. And it's really important for all of us to try and elevate everyone else's gifts and strengths, because once we all start working together, then the body starts, you know, you can tell I'm not planning this bit, doing better things. So we have unity, but in Paul's words, we have unity, but we're not the same. People, there's a little mantra at the moment, unity, but not uniformity, which I think is a nice way to put it. We can be coordinated and aligned and working together without needing to be identical, without needing to be the same. And this is true in our small groups, it's true in our families, but it's also true at church level, as we've kind of just explored. And then it's true across Maidenhead, so you can kind of zoom out a little bit. And you've got all kinds of different churches, and each church is kind of like its own poema, its own poem. And you've got different expressions, different flavors of what church can look like. And it's really exciting. Generally, I think we're working more and more closely together. We have stronger and stronger relationships with the churches in our town. And what's so exciting about that is when you start to add that together, it's like you can see what God is doing across Maidenhead. And there's a story there. There's a poem there of God at work in our town. And I actually think, looking at our churches, we do a better job serving our town because each church is a little bit different. Each church has different strengths and weaknesses. And it's wonderful that we're able to work together like that. And then, of course, you zoom out and out and out and out. And you've got this global church. Back in the day of Paul, 7,000 people, about the same size as Maidenhead. Makes me think, should we be more ambitious about what we can do in Maidenhead? But today, there are 2.6 billion of us. I don't know how you count them, but there are 2.6 billion of us. And we're all filled with just such splendid differences across the world, massively different ways of expressing our love for Jesus. And so our lives are poems. Our church is a poem, as is the church across Maidenhead, as is the church across the world, as is Pioneer, all these different ways of God expressing his gifts and ministries in the world. And I tried to think of a metaphor for you to bring me saying the word poem to life 10 times. So it reminds me a little of the London 2012 Olympic opening ceremony, where you had tons of different scenes, like little vignettes of different things about British culture in different ways. So you had loads of dancers and actors and writers involved in every single scene. And they covered things like Mr. Bean, James Bond, so quite wildly different perspectives on Britain. You got the NHS, Industrial Heritage. I don't remember any of the others, but there were more. And I think if you were to zoom in on any single dancer, on any single scene, that one dancer would be incredible to watch. Really talented, one of the best of the British performers. And you could watch their dance and it alone would be like an amazing creative act. But then you zoom out and you watch the whole scene. Like I remember they had the cameras and helicopters and you could see the whole stadium with what was going on. And it was an incredible picture. The one that sticks in my head is the NHS one and how the whole thing was lit up in blue. But then you kind of zoom out and you've got the whole story across all the different scenes. And then it, over the course of it, makes what I continue to think is one of the best performances of any kind we've ever had. And the church is meant to be like that. Our own performance is beautiful in its own right, but then it scales up to this cosmic thing across time and history that we're a part of. And so this was Paul's message to a nervous, fragmented church dotted across the world feeling alone. And it explains why Paul is kind of explaining why unity isn't just nice why unity isn't just a lovely idea. Some of these things we talk about in church can sometimes end up being sort of, as I said earlier, a bit tweeified, but actually unity is critical for churches. And it continues to be, even though there are more of us. And it's critical because it's God's plan for how he's going to put the world right. It's God's plan for how he's going to put everything back together again. Be all kinds of different people, different languages, different races, personalities, shapes, sizes, stories, backgrounds, all kinds of different categories, all dividing walls broken down. That's how Paul puts it in Ephesians. So that's a vision of the future, where the world is headed. Sadly, we can see it's not there yet. It doesn't even always feel like it's going in that direction, but it is. One day in the future, we'll be there. But for us now, in the 21st century today, in this room, and those people 2,000 or so years ago who nervously read that letter for the first time, it's what we're meant to live out at the moment. This is the calling for our lives today. It's the life that we're meant to model within our church, within our town, and as far as we're able, across the global church as well. And so to finish, I'm just going to pray in a moment. And then I thought it would be nice for us to just take a few moments and perhaps in groups, pray for some of the other churches in our town who are meeting this morning, just as an expression of, you know, how we love our brothers and sisters around the town. And so, Father, I thank you for the wonderful letter that Paul wrote to the people of Ephesus and around. I thank you for what that church became, that we are here united with that church because of what they did. It's amazing. I thank you that the picture you paint of a future where the world is brought together, is summed up in Christ, is something that we can point towards in how we live together as a church. And I pray for each of us this morning that you'd speak to us about our gifts and our ministries and how we can play our own part in our church about what that should look like. And I also pray, Holy Spirit, that you'd speak to each of us about where we need to grow, where we need to grow in humility, where we need to grow in gentleness, in patience, where we need to get better at making allowance for other people's faults. And most of all, God, help us to each grow in love. Amen. So I'll just let everyone make your own groups and pick a church nearby that you'd like to pray for. And then I'll pass back to Adam.